everyone. Welcome back to Name Drop San Diego. I'm Christy Totten, one of your hosts, along with Abby Hamblin. Our guest today is a true force. So Leanne Kim is an Emmy Award-winning journalist who worked as a news anchor and reporter for ABC News 10 here locally. And she's also the founder of the Pacific Arts Movement, which puts on the San Diego Asian Film Festival. Kim joined us by Zoom recently from her home in Sorrento Valley. We hope you enjoy the interview. Well, Leanne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're really excited to have this conversation. So, you know, the Asian Film Festival just wrapped up. How did it go? And like, what was it like to put that on during a pandemic?
Well, I'm no longer there, you know, I'm no longer the executive director.
I did not know.
Yeah. So it went well. I think that I still am involved in the periphery, but I no longer run the day-to-day operations. Thank God, because I can't imagine what it must be like for any nonprofit or any organization that's trying to bring people together, what it must be like to still exist during the pandemic when we need one another and when we need storytelling more than ever before. Based on what I saw and based on what they were able to present, they still presented 125 films from all over the world. And did a couple of drive-in films. I mean, I've never been to a drive-in movie until I had to, you know, until I created this organization, and 21 years later, they presented a drive-in movie at Scion Market. It was amazing.
I love the drive-in.
Oh, really? I've never been to one before. Where have you been to a drive-in?
In my hometown, but I've also been to the one in South Bay like several times. It's really fun.
That's so cool. Yeah. I love how it's coming back. I haven't been either. It's on my list.
It's so hip, you know? And before it's like, oh, I don't know. You know, I'd rather just, you know, be able to get my popcorn and everything. But there's something really nostalgic. And so what's old is what's new now.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
So are you still involved with Pac Arts then?
I am involved, you know, kind of as an advisor. As a founder, I will always be involved. It's like my baby that's gone off to college. Aww. And so they'll check in with me every once in a while to get some feedback or advice. To be honest, I am kind of hands off. And it's great. One of the reasons why I left Pac Arts is because I gave birth to the film festival and Pac Arts before I actually gave birth. So it was my first baby, right? And so when I gave birth to it in the year 2000, that was our very first film festival. It was 5 years later that I had my first child. And then 6 years later, we adopted our second child. And they were always like second or third fiddle. When you start something and it's your baby, you put your whole life and energy and heart into it. And there was a time when they were 9 years old and we were watching a movie about Martin Luther King Jr. And after the movie, they said to me, they said, gosh, mommy, I'm so glad we didn't live during that time because Black people had such a hard time. And I said, you know, actually, they still are. They said, well, at least since we're white, it would be easier on us. Wow. And my mouth just dropped because, you know, my kids are full Korean, you know, Korean American. And I said, what do you mean you're white? And they looked, you know, they raised their arm and they said, look, because we're white, we're not Black. And here I am, someone who dedicated her life to representing, you know, people of color and the marginalized and running an Asian film festival. And for my children to think that they were white, I was astounded. And I realized I was doing so much for the community. I needed to take some time to look into my own family and figure out how do I explain to these children what it means to be a person of color living in this country, in this city. And of course, the next year is when Donald Trump started running and they finally started to understand what it meant to be different because the leadership was speaking a different language. And there were kids at their school that were saying things that they had never heard before, right? So long story short, that's one of the main reasons why I left Pac Arts is because I realized I had done my duty and now I needed to be a good parent and make up for the years that I wasn't home.
Wow, that's an incredible story. What is their experience or understanding of race now?
I think, well, they're 15 and 14, so they understand that being Korean American is very special, that we're from a certain country that has its own language, it has its own history. Unfortunately, I couldn't even teach them that because my parents, who are immigrants, and I'm actually an immigrant from Korea, they just assumed I would know. We never had those kind of conversations. And so as a result of me having more time and space, I kind of looked through opportunities for them to learn more about themselves. And I send them every year to Michigan, of all places, to a Korean cultural camp where the majority of the kids who attend, they are mostly the only Asians in their school, the only Asians in their neighborhoods. And for my kids to be around other kids to feel their pain and also their isolation has had them become more empathetic and also become more proud of who they are. So I think they have a very good idea of who they are. And what I love about them too is like, they don't like K-pop, but they love looking like K-pop.
What?
Now my son, my older son, he has purple hair right now. And the other
awesome.
One, like blonde hair. And they like, you know, they look K-pop-y. And I love that they are connected to that part of the culture, uh-huh. you know, and they love Korean food. So
that sounds very cute. I would love to see a picture of them.
I'll send it over.
Yeah. So what really, I mean, we know you worked, as a news anchor for a very long time, but what about cinema, you know, what about Asian film made you so inspired to really put together the festival here in San Diego?
Oh, because it was all brand new, you know. So I was born in 1970 in Korea and grew up in Chicago in the Midwest. And, you know, in the 70s, you know, television is the way that I learned how to speak English through Electric mm-hmm. Company, through Zoom. There was a show called Zoom. Of course, Sesame Street. And I was a child of television from the 70s and 80s, and there were very few Asian Americans. There was Bruce Lee, there was Connie Chung, and there was Pat Morita on Happy Days. But beyond that, very, very few. And so as I got older, I recognized and was reminded many times of how I was different. People would ask me, where are you from? And I would say Chicago. And they would say, no, where are you from? How did you learn how to speak like that? Oh, you're Korean? You're not Chinese? What is that? I had to figure out my story pretty quickly. And I had to be able to tell my story from a young age, you know? So later on in life, I ended up going into television news because I wanted to be able to tell the stories of those who are marginalized or didn't have a voice or didn't have a seat at the table. And when I came here to San Diego, it was, I think, in my first or second year, I became president of the Asian American Journalists Association. And during that time, I actually met many Asian American filmmakers. I didn't even know Asian American filmmakers existed. You know, I did see Joy Luck Club, you know, in the late 90s, and that was, or in the early 90s, and that was a game changer for me to see strong women on the big screen speaking without an accent, talking about their Asian American experience. That was amazing, but I didn't know that there was a whole industry of these kind of stories and people. And when I did, I thought, well, why don't we try to put one on in San Diego? And that was in 1999 when we came up with the idea. We threw it out there, and I could not believe we had more than 100 entries into our festival.
Wow.
I didn't even know that anything like this existed. So that first year, we put together a selection of 60 films. We opened with the very first ever Filipino-American feature film called The Debut by Jean Cajayon. This was at USD. And I swear to God, when I showed up for that screening, there were more brown people on the campus of USD than that campus ever seen ever. I wasn't sure if they were going to freak out, but there were brown people like all the way around, you know, the building down the street. And it was because of the energy and the interest to see ourselves, right? Even though we know these stories intricately, to see ourselves is such a validation, and it's so new, right? It's so new. And that next year was 9/11. Our festival was 2 weeks before 9/11 hit. And on the day of 9/11 was actually our press screening of a film that was set in New York City that starred South Asians, you know? And I realized then, because, you know, at that time, George Bush was talking about the axis of evil and, you know, what it means to be American. And, you know, when you think about the axis of evil, who was it? Afghanistan, Iraq, North Korea, all countries in Asia. Okay. I knew that our festival was not just about a place to kind of express ourselves and for creative expression. I knew we now had to present a safe space for people to learn about one another and to celebrate one another and to love one another, build compassion for one another, because that really is what is American, right? The festival is very American. And so that's kind of the origin story of the festival. It first was like, wow, this is so new. I didn't know this existed. And then it was like, oh shit, you know, 9/11, we got to do something about this. And so I had this, you know, commitment from then on to present this space for San Diego and for artists of color to come together and tell these stories.
You mentioned Joy Luck Club, which I love so much. Like, I ugly cry hard through the whole thing, regardless of how many times I see it, you know, because it is about, you know, American born Asian people like myself who like don't, who are just spoiled and bratty and don't appreciate everything their parents have gone through. But, you know, for the longest time, right, like 20 years or something, that was the only sort of full Asian casted movie, you know, but now we've seen Crazy Rich Asians, we've seen Parasite, Minari people are talking about, and you've been doing this a long time, but like, what does it mean to you to finally see some breakthrough in the mainstream?
Oh, wow. It means so much, right? It means that we are less othered and that it's finally cool to be Asian, and it's definitely cool to be Korean, you know, like, I remember being in the 80s. Oh God, this is so embarrassing. So the cool Asians in the 80s were the Filipinos, okay? Not the Koreans, not the Chinese or Japanese, because we were nerdy, okay? The East Asians were nerdy. The Filipinos had the basement parties or the garage parties with the DJ, and they knew how to hip hop. I mean, they were the first, you know, I think one of like the API community that, you know, was into rap and knew how to dance, and they partied all night. So
this is amazing. I didn't know that.
Oh my God. Well, this was at least in Chicago. And I remember there was a point in my life, I only dated Filipino breakdancers. If you were Puerto Rican breakdancer,
that's awesome.
Not interested in you. If you're a Filipino but couldn't breakdance, not interested in you. I only dated Filipino breakdancers.
Very specific.
Yeah, it was very specific. And I remember thinking, like, I wish God that I was born as a Filipino, you know? So I had all my Pinay girls and I learned how to speak Tagalog, you know, I ate my lumpia. I never tried the pulut, by the way, but pulut is like this egg that has the full chicken side that they say is delicious, but I never got a chance to, you know, get the nerves to eat it. But, you know, it means that it's cool, you know, and it's okay, and it's accepted. You know, the fact that, you know, there are food trucks now who are doing like Korean street tacos, you know, the fact that BTS, I was, you know, at the mall yesterday and I heard BTS playing on the radio. I mean, that's freaking amazing. And I thought to myself, like, I could never imagine back in the 80s or 90s listening to, you know, Asian international music on our radio. You know, I see people learning how to speak Chinese. My kids are in a Chinese language school, like an immersion school. So they've been learning how to speak Chinese since they were five. And there are, you know, Latinx students, there are Black students, there are white students there. it's just, it's great. And it shows that, you know, we are all very different, but we all kind of want the same thing, right? To live a good life here in the United States, do good for the community, be educated, you know, contribute, have a house, you know, that we're not different. And I love the fact that more people know who we are, and also the differences of the Asian community, that we're not a monolith. Before, people would think we're all Chinese, right? Or all Japanese. That's all they knew. But now they know that there's Thai, or there's Hmong, or there's the Karen, or there's Filipino, right? And then there's the South Asian community. So it's great. it's a time for celebration.
I think that is one of the huge topics. I want to get back to films in a little bit, but just since you brought it up, that's one of the big conversations right now with the election being over. Is especially, we've seen a lot of news stories about Latino voters and, you know, how they're not a monolith. That word monolith is everywhere right now. But, you know, what kind of work has been done, and what are your thoughts toward sort of how the efforts have been made to make that known? You know, you can't just take the Latino vote for granted. You can't just take the Asian vote to mean one thing. And whether it's with the election or not, you know, what kind of work have the communities done, and what more needs to be done to sort of make that more of a conversation that everybody is a part of?
That's a really good question. And this is something that we have been thinking about a lot in the APIA community. The problem with the API community is that it is so diasporic, right? The diaspora, whether, you know, there's dozens and dozens of countries with dozens and dozens of languages and religions and shades of color. And we all came in different waves and for different reasons. I think many people, when they think of Asian Americans, they think about like the Chinese and the Japanese. And the Chinese who came here, many of them, especially as of late, and including Koreans as well. My father came because he was a doctor. So we came because of his privilege, right? And so I have a completely different experience than the Vietnamese who came here to San Diego through Camp Pendleton in 1975, escaping the war, and came with nothing. Right? And that had to start from nothing. And many of whom had to clean houses or, you know, open up noodle shops, you know. And then there's the Karen or the Hmong who came here as refugees. So when we talk about work, our work, it just depends on where we are, you know, in our journey as Americans here. I feel that, you know, Chinese and the Japanese tend to be a lot more engaged with elections and politics because they've been here longer, right? Koreans are starting to get engaged. In fact, this year, for the first time, we had 5 Korean Americans run for Congress. And of those 5, 4 actually made it. So we're sending 2 Democrats, 2 Republican Korean Americans. And I'm not saying that I'm going to, you know, just because they're Korean, I support them. But it signals that these communities are ready and engaged, right? You know, I'm going to use Prop 16 as an example. So Prop 16 for affirmative action, even though California is majority blue and went for Biden and Kamala Harris, it overwhelmingly did not vote for Prop 16. And I'm going to blame, you know, my Asian American brothers and sisters for being a big part of that. Those who are engaged politically tend to have been here a little bit longer. Many of them are East Asian, especially in the Chinese community, who came here as a result of privilege because their parents came, or they came as a result of having advanced degrees, coming here, you know, for science, engineering, or medicine. And they see Prop 16 as a threat to their children getting into the UC system. Unfortunately, they don't know that since Prop 209 affirmative action has gone away, the number of Asian Americans, you know, in the UC system has actually gone down, you know. It's very interesting, the divides within the Asian American community. We're still trying to figure that out. And I think one of the big causes of us not being able to get together is that there aren't enough Asian Americans in full-time positions, who are working in civic engagement. And like here in San Diego, I can think of just a handful of Asian American led organizations where they are full-time paid positions, right? And so the rest of everybody who's running their small community orgs, they're mostly volunteer. So if you're not doing this year round full-time and you're not, you know, focused on engaging the larger API community in being politically engaged, then there's gonna be a vacuum of leadership. And that's where San Diego is right now. But there's a new, younger, energetic crop of, you know, Asian Americans here who are trying to figure that out. And how can we, you know, elevate the level of participation and understanding across the board? But first, we have to, you know, kind of figure each other out, because so many of us come from different places with different histories and different levels of, you know, economic adjustment in San Diego. And that really makes a difference.
Yeah. How do you go about doing that? Is there like an organization, you know, where all sorts of different Asians are meeting? I mean, where can people go to get involved in that?
That's the whole problem, right? That's the whole problem. And so, you know, the pandemic was a blessing in disguise, at least for the Asian American community, because there was one, you know, issue that we can all get behind, and that was the overwhelming amount of hate and xenophobia that was stirred up, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, that we saw not just here in California, but across the nation, right? And so that allowed many Asian Americans who are in leadership positions and also average citizens to say, what can we do about this? And as a result of that, there were a number, I think like maybe 60 plus smaller Asian organizations who came together during the pandemic to put together a joint statement that I know the Union Tribune had mentioned, and that also that the city of San Diego adopted. To say, you know, we need to stand against this kind of xenophobic rhetoric, and we need to be cognizant as a community that this is happening. So it's happening in ways like that, right? We need to have negative events that happen as a whole to the Asian community, unfortunately, sometimes for them to come together. But at least now there's a coalition that's been formed here in San Diego. I think it's just really called the APIA Coalition. And that's a place where we can start and have those conversations.
Before we move too much further from the film festival, I just wondered if you could share some of the movies over the years, or storylines, or documentaries that really moved you, or that, you know, you would share that give somebody an idea of what the festival is about.
Oh my gosh. That's like, now you're asking me.
That's a lot of years, I understand.
So I ran it for 16, it's now in its 21st year. And so the film Marathon was about a mother who had an autistic child. And, you know, we rarely see autistic children being depicted to begin with. And it's based on a true story. And, you know, it was our opening night film, and I could not believe how many people came out who had autistic children. Mm-hmm. So like the Autism Society found out about the movie, they came, they watched it. And I could not, I'll never forget how many parents came up to me afterwards just crying. And the reason why they were crying is because in the movie, I think the director really depicted how difficult it was. And no matter how much they tried to explain that to their brothers or sisters or other members of their family or their parents about how hard it is to raise an autistic child, this movie expressed exactly how they felt and their experience. And it was in Korean. And what was so touching is that these were parents who were non-Korean, white, Chinese, American, you know, from, and yet they were all kind of speaking the same language after the movie. And that was really so moving for me to see how film could make them heal and to bring people together just in a short 90 minutes. You know, that to me was really incredible. And there's another film that we played. We do these films downtown for senior centers because a lot of there's a lot of Chinese seniors downtown, believe it or not. And so we played this film from Taiwan. It was from the 1950s called The Rear Entrance. And there was a white woman in the screening. And afterwards, she came up to us. And again, she had tears in her eyes. And she was like, "That was the first time I ever watched a subtitled movie." And we said, "That's great. It's never too late to, you know, have new experiences." And she just was so, her name is Joy. And she said, "I just can't believe it. I can't believe they're just like me." And we said, "Who?" She said, "Those people." And she was pointing at the Chinese seniors who really couldn't speak English. She said, "Wow. I thought they were so different. But after watching this movie, I realize now that we're all kind of the same, and I feel so bad." And we just said, well, sometimes it takes looking outside of your culture to know more about yourself. And then she just started bawling. And oh. And we call that story Tears of Joy, you know?
Wow.
Yeah, and but you know, there's stories of non-Koreans. We had a Black filmmaker who did a film about the about Black people in Japan. And that was really eye-opening because they're like, you know, quite frankly, in Japan and Korea and other countries, they are very racist towards non-Japanese, non-Koreans. And to see stories like that kind of reminded us that we need to be vigilant and that this still happens. And sometimes we come to this country with some of those racial prejudices and we need to deal with that. So, you know, and there's a million other films over the years that have touched me so deeply. You know, every film is made without the guarantee that anyone's going to ever see it. And most of these films are made because the filmmaker has this intrinsic need to tell the story. I don't know why it gets so emotional. Because stories are what, you know, help make our lives important. It gives meaning to our lives. You know, otherwise we live in black and white, and stories help us live in full color, right? And I'm just so grateful that we've been able to create this space where these stories that have no guarantee of an audience or any guarantee of making any money, that these filmmakers made these films for us to make us better, you know, and make our communities better and to help bridge us to one another.
Thank you for sharing that. Do you have a personal story that you're holding on to that needs to be told, either, you know, in movie form, book form, however that might be? Is that something that you think about?
I have lots of little stories, you know, that have, I think we all do, right? That when you think about, like, why did you, Christy, or why did you, Abby, end up working in journalism? And it probably has to do with a lot of little things that happened to you when you were younger. So I'll share with you two stories. One was in second grade, and I was just a talkative little kid. And in, you know, in school, they just couldn't handle a talkative little Asian American girl. And I remember Mrs. Heffel, my teacher at that time, she just was reading a book and I was talking. I couldn't help myself. And she was like, put her foot down. She said, "That's it." And she put me in the corner and she made a dunce cap for my head out of brown construction paper. And she taped my mouth shut with, I love how like both of your mouths are like open.
Well, I didn't know that this was actually a thing, like dunce caps. And yeah. I mean, especially not a teacher putting something on your face.
Well, I mean, that was the only time that happened to me, but it happened in 1978. And she taped my mouth shut. And I was so embarrassed and I felt so ashamed. And I also couldn't tell my parents because they would have beat me, right? I mean, Asian parents are like, if the teacher did something to you to do that, that means that you were a bad student. So I never told my parents about this. And what's the irony in that is that I ended up speaking for a living and that woman shut me up, right? And so it's like, touche, Mrs. Heffel. You yes. shut me up. But it also is a reminder of when kids at that age, you know, when I look at my kids and they don't want to do certain things or they're really apt to do a certain way, it's because that's who they are, right? And how can we, I look at that experience and I look at how can I not keep the mouth shut of my children, but encourage them to keep speaking or keep doing what they want to do. So that's one story that was really interesting that I reflect on a lot about how I turned out the way that I am. And the other one was when I was a freshman in high school, again, this is when I was hanging out with Filipino breakdancers. I was really into hip hop. I loved Beat Street. I loved the Electric Boogaloo. I loved Breakdancing 1 and 2. Those are movies that I watched. And I was really close friends with a Filipino DJ. And I decided for our high school talent show that I was going to write a rap and that the DJ was going to scratch and mix.
And I hope you're about to perform it for us.
Yeah,
right,
there
now.
Better be a video somewhere.
There's no video, but I still remember.
Do you remember?
Okay, so yeah. No, all you rock and
no.
This is me. I've come to you real cordially. I've got the beat and the funky rhythm too. And to rock a rap is what I plan to do. Rock up, rock down, rock inside out. We'll be bopping, there's a stopping, there's a screaming shout. So keep to the beat of the supersonic sound. And soon I'll rock you right to the ground. Hold on to your hats and hold on to your feet and make some room for an elite. Blah, blah, blah.
I am crying. That is so amazing.
Lame. It's so lame, but that's how like the 80s like hip hop was. It was like,
that is not lame. That is incredible. Well, and you're for sure the first rapper to ever that we've ever had on the show. That's the first rap that was ever performed on Name Drop. So thank you.
Okay, yeah, that was sick. That was not embarrassing. That was
I'm probably going to regret that I did that because I've never done that before.
Okay. I'm sorry though. I cut you off.
No, that's okay.
Thank you so much though.
Well, so it's legit, right? So I legitimately wrote a rap and I went to my high school tryouts for the talent show, and then the list came out of who made it, and I went and I looked at that list. I was so mad that I didn't make it, and I'm sure it has something to do with they didn't understand rap and what is this Asian girl doing rap, she's not black, you know, I don't know, but I didn't make it. And I looked at the list and not a single person of color was on that list. Now, before then, I was never cognizant of like, you know, representation. It was more about like supporting myself in arguing why I should be in the talent show. So I went straight up to the teacher. She's an acting teacher who was in charge of the talent show. And I called her racist. I called the school racist. I said, you know, how dare you? You don't know. I practiced so hard. And as a result of that, I was recruited to be on the school speech team. And wow. I ended up becoming a state champion in humorous interpretation and original comedy. And that led me to arts, to theater, to broadcast school, a lot of things. And it was because of my failed rap. In my freshman year. So that's kind of my origin story. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it's so inspiring how you like showed them, you know, you faced this adversity and really made the best of it.
Well, but at the time I didn't really understand, you know, really what I was talking about with representation. But I see many years later, right, that that representation does matter and that somehow maybe I was born to do this work. I don't know. I don't know how I, other than for my own self-preservation, right? I don't know why I did that, but I'm glad I did because I am now still talking about, hey, we need a seat at the table. Hey, let's take a look at the composition of who's been invited, right? And even within the Asian Film Festival, we're very careful, right? Of like, we don't want to do too much Korean or too much Chinese or, you know, we got to do the stories off the beaten path. And, you know, we even did many, many films, Persian films and films from Iran and India, and even Kazakhstan, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, who knew that there were movies from Kazakhstan? And how else would you see them except through, an organization like Pacific Arts Movement. But, you know, I still hold that as a value today.
Yeah, I was going to say, speaking of representation and also hip hop, you turned 50 this year.
Yes.
And in order to improve visibility for you know, women, you started a flash mob hip hop dance crew. Can you tell us about that?
It's like my little side crew. So I'm 50 now, which means I'm officially middle-aged. But in Korea, you're middle-aged after you get married and have children. And so usually like 35 and up, you're considered an ajumma. So ajumma today is a pejorative term, actually. So now they don't use ajumma to refer to women. They use imo, which means big aunt, you know, auntie, right? So the word ajumma is actually becoming obsolete in Korea. But here in the United States, Korean Americans, we're just like, hey, ajumma. And I thought, you know, it's interesting because I feel like as a woman, and especially a woman who left television and who left running an organization and who's now, you know, a mom. So I'm the COO of the Song household, right? I feel in some ways invisible, and sometimes I wonder if I'm relevant, right? But of course I'm freaking relevant. I'm changing the world by raising two boys in a way that's compassionate and kind. But women, especially middle-aged women, tend to be forgotten and or just kind of passed. So I thought, let's reclaim this word ajumma, and let's get together with, you know, using the whole kind of Korean spunk that I have. Let's bring together a group of middle-aged ladies to do hip hop, like flash mob, and surprise people. Because it's all about like turning people's stereotypes upside down, right? So it's called Ajumma EXP. EXP is kind of for experiment, experience, and it also sounds K-pop-y, you know, BTS, Ajumma EXP, you know? And we do these hip hop dances to full on hip hop, like we went to Missy Elliott, to Janet Jackson. Everyone's like, why don't you do to K-pop? I'm like, no, that's too obvious, right? So we got to do to old school hip hop and go out and just surprise people. And we dress ourselves as like kind of old fashioned, stereotypical, older Asian ladies with those tight perms and big, you know, flowery pants and wow, mismatched shirt. And it's been really cool. And one of our flash mobs, we got like 250,000 views, right, online. But I felt like I made it when I saw like hundreds of comments from young kids who said, I can't wait to get older. Or if this is what it looks like to get older, sign me up. You know, it's so like we made it cool to get older again, you know?
So
and
cool.
It was so great. And so that's what we do. And yeah, we have a couple of surprises up our sleeves always. So check us out online.
Yeah, I watched the video on the homepage that you sent me. So impressive. I would definitely recommend people check it out. So Ajumma, it's AJUMMAEXP.com.
Yes.
Okay.
That's amazing. Is it mostly San Diego women? Like who did you find to join you in this?
Oh, it's all mostly San Diego women. It started off with my friends. And then when we started a Facebook page, people were like, please let me join. And I was like, sure, you can join. And you don't have to be Korean. You just have to be middle-aged and have a fierce commitment to being badass. You know, if you're badass and willing to throw down with us, we're willing to take you in. But you got to put in the work because there's practice involved. And there's a little bit of courage that it takes, you know, because I think a lot of us care so much about what other people think still. I mean, we work so hard to get to this point and we still care about what other people think. And some of that through Ajumma EXP, we've learned to shed and love ourselves as we are today. I wish, and there's other women all over the country who want to start Ajumma EXP chapters. And I'm like, do it, I'll help you. But it started here. We're homegrown in San Diego.
That's awesome.
I cannot wait till we can see this live, like post-pandemic.
And I hope that you can incorporate rap somehow because that is your destiny. Oh, that was amazing.
Oh my God.
Yes.
That rap needs to be seen by the public.
This was very cool. I don't do this for anybody, you guys.
Yeah, thank you so much. I wanted to ask you, you know, my grandmother once told me, like, we were talking about what was her favorite age, and she told me when she turned 50, that's when she started caring less about what people thought and just, you know, sort of went her own way without really considering that. Like, what is your experience been? You know, what are some of the sort of things we have to look forward to, you know, as we get older?
There's different stages, right? So as you're younger, you're like, oh, I can't wait to graduate from college and then everything's gonna be okay. Then college is like, oh, I can't wait to get married and everything's gonna be okay. Then, oh, you get married and having children, right? Every point is a different part of your journey. And every part of my journey has been so special. I don't have a favorite one. I am still learning as we go. And I will say that I feel that now that I'm older and I have children and I've had a couple of years of experience becoming a mother and learning what it means to be a parent, I will tell you, I have no idea what I'm doing. I still don't. In life, I have no idea what I'm doing. And I live by this mantra, which is, I am letting go. I am going with the flow, and I welcome new unfolding, which means that, you know, whatever is to come, whatever has passed, I am living right now. And right now, as a mother, as a middle-aged woman, I am enjoying my life. And I am now also a student, and my teachers are my children, right? We think that we own our children. They're my kids, right? And I have learned that, holy cow, they're 14, 15. My job right now is to let them go. I don't own them. And every day through their, you know, hormonal kind of talk back to me and their lip, you know, and talking back and also like really questioning everything that I tell them to do, they're really teaching me so much on what it means to be human, what it means to be compassionate, what it means to have really to love somebody. Every day I am learning. So I'm in a good place because I think when we stop learning is when we stop living. And so my kids have become my ultimate teachers, you know?
That's so awesome. The teenage years, I just like kind of had like a flashback.
Right. Right. When you were a good kid, I was a horrible kid. I don't know about you. Were you rebellious or were you good to your parents?
Also terrible.
maybe we should bring my parents on the show to talk about that. No, but I just realized we haven't really asked you too much about being a news anchor, which is how a lot of people know you in town. You are an anchor and reporter for Channel 10, KGTV 10, the ABC affiliate. What is like your favorite thing from doing that and your least favorite thing?
One of my favorite things is just being there. Just my presence itself was breaking down stereotypes, you know, being a woman of color, being an Asian woman, and being a Korean American woman meant a lot to this community and beyond, not just here, but in, for example, being in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, working in Springfield, Missouri, where it's 99.7% white. And I was the first person of color to anchor the news in that town. That meant a lot. You know, so that for me was such a privilege to play that role, be that role, and to represent. I will say that when I was in news, I left in 2008. You know, I worked at Channel 10 from 96 to 2008, and I feel like it's evolved since then. You know, in terms of management, you know, quite frankly, it was a very white male world. And, you know, one of the hardest parts was fighting every day for the story, for the lead story, right? I always had to fight when I was working dayside, I was fighting against every white man that had been there for, you know, 15, 20, 25 years. And guess what? They always got the best stories. And I remember very specifically one time, it was the opening day for the Padres. And I was the only woman on Dayside. And they wanted to do a fun pod race story. And they said, Leanne, we're going to assign you to do who's the hottest padre. I'm like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. Give that to Mark Matthews. I don't want to do that. I went to college and this is not what I went to college for. And they're like, sorry, you know, you have to do that. And so I did the story and, you know, talked to women and even men about who was the hottest padre. But I just felt like it was so beneath us. And there's days where you have to do those kind of stories. And I kind of relate it to being in a domestically violent relationship. You stay in because every once in a while you get, you know, a really good day and you stay for those days. But most of the time you're kind of beaten down and battered a little bit. You know what I mean? But I was in it for the long game, you know, for representation and for what it meant to our community. And so there were many days where I just had to like suck it up and to prove myself time and time again. And because of the fact that that representation mattered so much to me, even if it was a who's the hottest Padres story, I tried to do the best that I could. You know, you do the best that you can. Yeah. But I, you know, overall, it was a great experience, and everything that I have done today in San Diego is a result of me working at Channel 10. The contacts and the community in which I was able to cover and build relationships with, the ability to run and gun it every single day. You guys know, as journalists, you know, we're so incredibly resourceful, and all those skills helped me transition to becoming a great executive director, you know, and running a nonprofit, even though I had no idea what I was doing, figuring it out as we go, which many of us do in news. So I'm very, very grateful to KGTV and 10 News for giving me that opportunity.
I know we're sort of running out of time here, but I wanted to ask you, what has life after journalism been like? Is there life after journalism?
Oh, hell yes, girl. Come on to the other side.
Don't tempt us.
It's wonderful. You know, we all are trying to be unbiased and be fair, you know, and all that. But we also come to the table with experiences as women or as immigrants or as people of color or not, right? So no matter what, we have a bias coming to the table, and that bias shapes on how we ask our questions, who we interview, and all of that, right? So, but we try to keep it to ourselves because that's just what we're supposed to do when we're in news. Now that I'm out of news, I'm able to say, okay, I do support this particular candidate, or I do support this proposition, or I can speak out about Black Lives Matter, right? Or I can... I feel okay wearing a shirt like this that says Asian women rock my world, you know? Whereas before I felt like I was a little stifled. It's a little stifling. And there is so much liberation. In other words, I'm able to take the tape off my mouth.
Yes.
Wow, yes. Bring it a full circle.
You know, taking the tape off my mouth and being able to express myself fully and to be seen fully. You know, as journalists, we don't want to be seen, right? We just want others to be seen. And it's weird now to be able to be seen. And I'm still developing my voice in that way, in how I express my opinion, and to be able to, you know, out loud, talk critically about things. It's wonderful. Yeah, let me know when you want to join the other side. And we'll talk all about it.
This is making me feel really good, because I was one of those kids that was always in trouble for interrupting and talking too much in school. Like, my elementary school report cards would say, like, talks too much, and I'd get, you know, in trouble. And it is so nice to see that you're so right about those things that come naturally to kids. I'm doing a podcast now. I'm talking into a mic and for my day job, you know, so... I think you're so right. And especially what you said about your own kids, you know, you have to see who they are and just kind of let them shine.
Yeah, right.
And you've totally done that with your own life and are still doing it.
Well, thank you so much. That really means a lot. And I'm happy that you're out there speaking. We need more women out there to be doing the work, and this podcast is a great platform for the two of you, you know, because you guys are fun. I was actually really nervous, but from the very get-go, you guys made it so natural, and you're doing what you were born to do.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that means a lot to us. And actually, you're fun. You know, the guest makes a big difference.
Definitely. So speaking of kind of putting a spotlight on our stories and our voices, one of the things that I love about our show is that at the end, our podcast is called Name Drop San Diego. So we ask our guests if there's someone who either deserves more of a spotlight or who has just been really meaningful to them in San Diego County that they would like to name drop. So do you have a name drop that you would share with us?
Yeah, I do. Her name is Dr. Leva Chong, and she is a communications professor at the University of San Diego. She's also one of the reasons why the film festival started. She, like Christy, is an implant, and she was trying to kind of find her bearings, and actually she hated San Diego until she found out about, you know, that we were trying to start an Asian film festival, and she jumped right in. You know, and she's a Chinese American professor who is beloved at USD, has won a ton of awards for her teaching. And she's somebody that I really look up to and who has been a mentor to me over the years. And again, here's a situation where she's a teacher and has taught me so much and has carried me along. And I feel like, especially now during the pandemic, knowing what all the teachers, you know, are facing, is just such an uphill battle, you know, this kind of distance learning. I really appreciate her being an Asian American in communications, teaching mostly non-POC students on the importance of communication and diversity. So she's somebody that I really admire and think that San Diegans should know.
Beautiful. Leanne, thank you so much for joining us. This has been like so fun and insightful.
Thank you. You guys made me cry. You made me laugh and you made me rap. So I'm done for the day.
I wish everyone could see how we were vibing along with you. We were,
I know, definitely head bobbing.
Yeah. Yes. I'm kind of glad that they couldn't, but yeah, thank you guys so much for pulling the best and the worst out of me.